panel back on the virtual bench, then we will begin, but I'll should be just momentarily. Very good. The panel is reassembled, and so we will now hear oral arguments in the third case on today's calendar. That is case number A20-1006, State of Minnesota versus Brian Kenneth Larkins. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see a time clock on your screen if you have the gallery view or perhaps a similar view. And so you should be able to see your time remaining. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Brian Larkins. This court must reverse Mr. Larkins' conviction because the state did not prove he committed the crime that the district court instructed the jury the state had to prove. In the alternative, the court must reverse the conviction and remand for a new trial as a remedy for the prosecutor's misconduct when she told and repeatedly asked the jury to find Mr. Larkins guilty of a crime that the district court had not instructed the jury on. The central problem in this case is kind of an obvious one. The state wanted to prove that Mr. Larkins committed an assault harm by punching the complainant. And there was certainly evidence to support that accusation. But the jury could not have legitimately found Mr. Larkins guilty on that basis because the district court instructed the jury, quote, the term assault as used in this case means an act done with intent to cause Ms. Kyrus, that's the complainant, to fear immediate bodily harm or death, end quote. And that is the crime of assault fear, not the crime of assault harm.
Mr. Butler, if I can jump in at this point, because I think you're right to say that the central problem is that there's a discrepancy between the instruction and something else. And your argument is that the discrepancy is between the instruction given and the evidence slash arguments of counsel. You're not arguing that there's a discrepancy between the instruction given and the actual charged offense. And so I guess I want to clarify, are you conceding that the charged offense, which was assault harm, not assault fear, is not the relevant point of comparison that we should be looking at?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't quite follow the phrase relevant point of comparison, but I agree.
I can rephrase. Let me put a very fine point on it. This person was charged with assault harm. The instructions were assault fear. He was convicted. There is no question to a jury requiring them to make a finding that the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the charged offense. And so I'm asking you whether you're conceding today that your client can be convicted of a charge of a crime he was never charged of.
Sure. I understand, Your Honor. We have not raised a due process argument or a notice argument. I think that would have been difficult under these facts without a lack of objection and whatnot. So if that's your question, the answer is yes. What we're focused on is, as you said, the discrepancy between the instructionally charged offense and the evidence. Because if the state didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Larkins committed an assault fear, then really nothing else matters, including due process or anything else. and it's clear that the state did not prove that. And we know that because a couple things. One is the state, of course, never argued that Mr. Larkins committed an assault fear. They didn't charge him with assault fear, as Judge Bryan has pointed out. They didn't argue to the jury that he committed an assault fear. They never identified a particular act that he did that was done allegedly with the specific intent. And I think that's a really important part here, the specific intent to cause the complainant to fear immediate bodily harm or death.
And so if we do look at the circumstances proved, I didn't see in your brief the rational hypothesis from those circumstances that were proved at trial that's inconsistent with guilt. Is there a rational hypothesis that's inconsistent with guilt for an assault fear?
Sure, Your Honor. The rational hypothesis is that Mr. Larkins didn't care whether he scared the victim or not. Mr. Larkins punched the victim. Mr. Larkins wanted to physically hurt the victim, and he, according to the state's witnesses and viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, and I need to give those qualifications. That's what the state's witnesses say he did.
But so your argument is that he harmed, the evidence is that he harmed her with his mental state was that he was indifferent to whether he was going to scare her.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that comes back to what a specific intent means, because specific intent is just that. It is the specific desire to cause a particular result. And that language, I think I'm paraphrasing, but comes from State versus Fleck, kind of the seminal case on specific intent and general intent. And so Mr. Larkins has to, under the instructions, has to have actually thought to himself, what I want to do here is I want to scare her. And we all know what an assault fear looks like. Right? You point a gun at somebody and say, I'm going to kill you. That's an assault fear. The goal is to scare the person.
Is there ever a specific intent crime that can be proved by circumstantial evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Almost all specific intent crimes are proven by circumstantial evidence because you almost always have to have circumstantial evidence of what the defendant wants to do. So I don't have any problem with using circumstantial evidence. And I'm not saying that the state can't prove an assault fear unless the defendant specifically says, I want to scare you.
Well, when we're dealing with a circumstantial evidence case in a specific intent crime, why isn't it always a defense that he didn't intend to harm her? He just intended to, or he didn't intend to scare her. He just intended to harm her.
Yeah.
You see my point?
I do. And I think it could be a defense, Your Honor, but depending on the facts proven, I think that'd be a very, very, it'd be very difficult in a lot of assault fear cases to say that it is rational to believe that a person who does certain things doesn't intend to scare the victim. So, for example, if I point a gun at someone and say, I'm going to kill you, I suppose, and I'm convicted of assault fear, right? I could show up here on appeal and say, well, maybe I didn't intend to scare her. But I think this court would look at me and say, no, that's irrational. Because when you point a gun at someone and make a directly threatening comment, like I'm going to kill you, the only logical conclusion is that you wanted to scare the person. That's not true when during a physical melee over a cell phone, one domestic partner punches the other one in the face. That is an intent to punch the person in the face. And I suppose it could be reasonable to conclude that there was an intent to cause fear, although, again, the state has never identified what act Mr. Larkins did that evinced that intent. But let's say there was one. It's certainly not the only reasonable inference from those circumstances. And I would have to say that even if the evidence here is sufficient, that doesn't deal with the second issue in our brief, which is the misconduct issue. The prosecutor affirmatively told the jury to find Mr. Larkins guilty of, as Judge Bryan said earlier, a crime that not only was he not charged with, well, he was charged with, I take that back, it's the reverse. Find him guilty of the charged crime, but that's not the instructed crime. And the instructions, the court's instructions, characterize the law of the case. And so it's the instructions, that's the only crime that the jury can legitimately find the defendant guilty of, because it's the only crime the jury knows about. And when the prosecutor argues the opposite, contradicts the court's instructions, and asks the jury to find the defendant guilty of some other crime, that's misconduct. And the Supreme Court's decision in State versus Shannon, I realize it's a case that's getting old now, but it's from the mid-90s. And it makes that very clear. And it makes very clear a couple things. One, it makes clear that it doesn't matter that the defense attorney didn't object, that this is plain error, because the defense attorney in Shannon also did not object to the misconduct. Two, Shannon also makes clear that it doesn't matter that the instructions were proper, that there was no error in the instructions. There's no error in the instructions here. The court correctly set forth the elements of assault fear. That was also the case in Shannon. The district court correctly set forth the elements of, in that case, it was heat of passion manslaughter that was at issue. And so what we look at, though, is what was the case? And the reason that this conduct was so problematic here is because it encouraged the jury to do what lay jurors are bound to do, want to do anyway. and want to say, well, he punched her. That's an assault. Therefore, he's guilty. Done. We're done. We don't need any of this legal mumbo jumbo. And the state's case that Mr. Larkins punched the complainant was certainly strong. I mean, that's what all the witnesses testified to, that he punched the complainant. But the state's case that he committed an assault fear was, I don't know, we would say the evidence was insufficient, but at a minimum, it was weak. Again, there's no claim that he committed an assault fear. No one asked that he committed an assault fear. And so the jury—
there was certainly testimony. There was certainly unrebutted testimony that his behavior is preceding the actual harmful, the slap, were intimidating. I think there was some testimony that he puffed up really big, like a bulldog, and there was some other evidence tending to show dominance or intimidation that would instill fear in a reasonable person. And so what is the evidence that would undermine the strength of the state's case on an assault fear?
Your Honor, I think that's an interesting question because with all due respect, I think you're mixing up the facts of this incident with the facts of the relationship evidence incident that came in. On page 221 of the transcript, the district court admitted two acts of relationship evidence by Mr. Larkins. And on page 221, the complainant describes an incident in which Mr. Larkins wanted her to accompany him somewhere and was being threatening when doing so. And she says he was all puffed up and big, like he was a big old bulldog or something, and he was going to attack me. That's the relationship evidence incident. That's not the charged offense. And so I actually think that draws an interesting comparison because the relationship evidence incident shows what an assault fear looks like. And in fact, that's how the district court identified that particular conduct. When he says, you're coming with me, and he says it in a threatening tone and puffs himself up and makes himself threatening, that could be evidence of an intent to cause fear. That's not true here for the underlying acts or the acts leading up to the punch in this case are really quite chaotic, and they are almost entirely physical. Mr. Larkins cursed at a young lady, a juvenile who was a friend of the one of the children in the house and was sitting with the complainant. I don't believe there's testimony that he cursed at the complainant. The one line that sort of spouts the whole thing off, shut the F up, is directed at the young lady. Then he allegedly elbows the complainant in the face. So that's a physical thing. And then he gets in a brawl with the young man over the cell phone. They proceed downstairs. The brawl continues. Mr. Larkins charges up to the complainant, who's trying to calm him down, and punches her in the face. That's a physical assault. If that happened, that's an assault harm, and that's what the state wanted to prove. So,
but the behavior surrounding the assault in this particular the assault that forms the basis of the charge or the convicted offense are informed by the previous acts of the defendant, which are intimidating in nature. That relationship evidence.
Sure, and I think that could get to why the complainant might be scared. But that doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt, to the exclusion of all other reasonable inferences, that Mr. Larkins specifically intended to scare her.
But I think my point, or what I'm trying to probe you about, is why is the state's case not strong given the entirety of the evidence that was presented? His history of intimidating behaviors, his history of assaultive behaviors, and then the acts leading up to the offense for which he was convicted here, which culminated in the physical, the harm to the complainant. Why is that not a strong case?
Sure. I think, first of all, I think you could say if it was such a strong case, they probably would have charged it, but they didn't. Number two, so that's a context clue as to how strong the case was. But number two, you have to go back and look at what the element actually is, which is that the state has to identify an act done with specific intent to cause fear of death or bodily harm. And they haven't identified an act. It's not enough to, you know, sort of pluck out of the air that maybe he had this intent or not. There is no act here. And again, even if you could, I realize the standard review on sufficiency claims is you know, an uphill battle, even on circumstantial evidence. You know, if you
Mr. Butler, are you saying that you can never use 63420 evidence to prove specific intent on an assault fear? It's just, you can't, Okay. So what kinds of things would be proper for this court to infer or, you know, to use to exclude other inferences based on the 63420 evidence here? If you can use that to establish specific intent for assault fear on this date, then what, then it seems like, that there is some relevancy there. So what do you think we can look to from the 63420 properly here today?
I'm not sure that it has much effect on whether Mr. Larkins intended to cause this complainant fear on the day in question. I think I can envision a different case where Mr. Larkins's actions are more ambiguous. The charge defense actions are more ambiguous. And the state could say, well, yeah, they're ambiguous. But if you look what happened previously, you can see what he's really doing here. You can see what the pattern of behavior is, and you can see what the context of this relationship is. And you can see that he's trying to scare her. Mr. Larkins's actions here are all physical. He wanted to hit her and he hit her. And so that's an assault harm, but it's not an assault fear. And as a result, we ask you to reverse Mr. Larkins' conviction.
I have one question if there are no follow-ups by my colleagues. Mr. Butler, with respect to your second argument, the prosecutorial misconduct argument, it seems possible that the analysis might lead us to the less often used fourth requirement of the plein air test, which asks whether the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceeding would be seriously affected. So in light of the fact that we know he punched her, and given that this misconduct is based on an error that seemed to kind of permeate the courtroom. Why would it not be unfair to affirm the conviction by going through all four steps of the modified plein air test?
Sure. First of all, I don't know that I've ever seen a conviction affirmed over a misconduct finding on prong four. There may be one out there. I'm not familiar with it. So I think that would be relatively unprecedented or at least extremely rare. Number two, Your Honor, Mr. Larkins has a right to a jury verdict based on the instructions that are given. And when a prosecutor, I can't imply intent here, and so I don't want to get into the prosecutor's head, and so please understand I'm not doing that. But when a prosecutor either ignores the district court's instruction or takes it upon herself to argue contrary to the district court's instruction, that's a kind of an assault on the district court too. And so I don't think that's the kind of thing that the fairness and public reputation of the judicial branch should condone. I also don't think that I come back to a little bit this layperson standard that we can't have prosecutors basically arguing to the jury to sort of, okay, let's cut through all the mumbo jumbo here and let's just say, look, he hit her, we're done. If that's the charge and that's the instruction and that's the case, then fine. But it's not. And so when you do that improperly, when you encourage the jury improperly to say, look, he hit her, we're done. What's all this mumbo jumbo doing? What you're really doing is you're attacking the presumption of innocence. You're attacking the defendant's right to a fair trial. You're attacking the defendant's right to a jury trial. And you're attacking the defendant's due process rights. And given if you assume that prongs 1, 2, and 3 are met, we have misconduct by the prosecutor, misconduct that was plain, and misconduct that was prejudicial and affected the defendant's substantial rights. I'm not saying there can never be a prong four case there. Maybe the defendant, let's say the misconduct, a lot of times you see misconduct in rebuttal arguments that is prompted by something the defense lawyer does. He presses her buttons, he says something improper, so she responds with something improper, something like that. That's not this case. And so I would encourage the court not to go down that road, Judge Johnson, and use prong four.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the state, you may introduce yourself and your client, and you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Abigail Lambert, Assistant Freeborn County Attorney. I was a prosecutor in this case, and I am, on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent. I said most of my argument in my brief, but there are a few points I would like to highlight. The state does request that this court affirm the appellant's conviction in this case. First, the state did prove beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant committed an act with intent to cause fear of immediate bodily harm or death. When reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence leading to a conviction, the court views the evidence in light most favorable to the verdict and assumes that the fact finder disbelieved any testimony conflicting with that verdict. The court must determine whether under the facts in the record, are there any legitimate inferences that can be drawn from them that a jury could reasonably conclude the defendant was guilty of the offense charged? So although the state's theory of the case here was domestic assault harm, the correct jury instruction was given based on the charge, and the evidence at trial did prove beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant committed domestic assault fear. We must assume that the jury followed the instructions given. The jury heard
Ms. Lambert. So Mr. Butler's argument is that the rational hypothesis inconsistent with guilt on a domestic assault fear is that the defendant acted to harm her, but he did not have the requisite mental state, the specific intent to cause her fear. And so why is that not a rational hypothesis inconsistent with guilt based on the evidence, the circumstantial evidence that was presented in the case?
Yes, Your Honor. So the jury heard multiple forms of testimony in this case that proved beyond a reasonable doubt that it was the appellant's intent to cause the victim fear. In regards to the victim's statements alone, there were numerous occasions where the defendant's or the appellant's actions made it clear this was his intent. I listed most of them in my brief, but just to name a few, the first one, I apologize, it is vulgar, but the appellant told the victim's friend to, quote, shut the fuck up. And then he proceeded to elbow the victim on her right cheek. Victim testified that appellant told her he was going to break her phone. While the victim was trying to calm appellant down, appellant came up and hit her with a closed fist. She testified it hurt. She was scared and didn't know what was going to happen. And we also heard testimony from the witnesses who indicated or who testified that the appellant ran toward the victim as she was trying to calm him down. This isn't a situation where the appellant was acting calm, standing still, and his intent was mistaken. This is a situation where the appellant, or this was not a situation where the appellant snuck up behind the victim and hit her on the side of the face. The jury heard testimony from more than one individual that the appellant ran toward the victim as he was trying to calm her down. So the rational inference here is that his intent was to cause her fear. Now, again, my theory of the case was harm. And it would have been helpful to have that jury instruction that coincided with my theory. And in retrospect, I should have asked for one. If I had a do-over, I would request that the instruction for both domestic assault harm and domestic assault fear be included. But again, the jury is presumed to have followed the judge's instructions, and they did properly convict the appellant of domestic assault fear in this case.
Ms. Lambert, if I could bring you back to Judge Frisch's question, I want to be very clear. The things that you've listed are consistent with somebody who might have specific intent. But the question for us is more precise than that. The question for us is, are those things inconsistent with someone who was simply mad, incensed, or indifferent as to whether or not his actions caused fear? So what is it about saying, shut the F up to the witness number two? What is it about elbowing the victim in the face? What is it about running up to her that would rule out indifference or anger and leave only fear as the intent, causing fear?
Yes. So if the defendant had simply been standing there and yelling at the victim and wasn't doing I think the court or the jury can take everything, all the testimony, all the evidence as a whole. It was the fact that he threatened to break her phone. It was the fact that he ran up to her. It would be unreasonable to think that his intent was not to cause fear when he's running up to the victim who is distraught and is trying to calm appellant down and then proceeds to punch her in the face. It would be unreasonable to think that that was not part of his intent in that case.
So when somebody runs up to another person, you're saying that that action always is done with the intent to cause fear?
So I think intent can't be proven directly. So I think with the circumstances the circumstances around the entire situation at play. This is a situation that started upstairs in the bedroom, proceeded downstairs. So if we just had a situation where the appellant ran up to the victim in this case, it may be more questionable. But the fact that he made threatening statements, he elbowed the victim upstairs. He made statements, threatening statements upstairs. The incident.
What was the threatening statement?
He told the friend of the victim who was next to the victim to shut the fuck up, and then he proceeded to elbow the victim in the face. So I guess I say that as being a threatening statement. Again, taking it all together as a whole. Going into, I talk a lot about State v. Dulbeck in my brief, and although it's clear that my theory of the case in this instance was the harm, the jury is presumed to have followed the law, and you don't need a unanimous verdict in regards to the underlying facts, just in regards to the element. So again, as I stated, intent cannot be proven directly. It's proven circumstantially. However, assault harm can be proven directly. And by proving the assault harm, a jury can reasonably infer that appellant's actions were the intent to cause fear. So different jurors can have different theories to explain that intent. One juror might say, well, I don't believe that the appellant said all those things because I believe he's the type of guy that just gets ramped up when he's angry. However, I do believe there was harm in this situation. And because there was that harm, I agree that his actions were the intent to scare her. This wasn't a sneak attack. Well, you could have had another juror say, well, I don't believe the victim was actually harmed, but I do believe his intent was to scare her based on the movements and yelling as described by other witnesses. So the theory that I argued was that first scenario, but instruction could have been given on both, and the jury doesn't need to agree on those underlying facts. They just need to agree that the element was proven. I would like to also note that there was not prosecutorial misconduct in this case. Standard of review is, as your honors know, that when a defendant fails to object at trial, we consider it under the plain error doctrine. An error is plain if it contravenes case law, a rule, or a standard of conduct. We don't have plain error here. I charge this case under Minnesota Statute 609.2242 Subdivision 4. Which specifically says whoever violates the provision of this section, and then it goes on to talk about the qualifying priors and what makes that subdivision a felony. But it says, but the statute doesn't specifically say whoever violates this section, subdivision 1, parent 1, or subdivision 1, parent 2. It encompasses them as a whole. So I didn't misstate the law in my closing argument, and I will note that the judge in this case, above the elements, did indicate in the definition of domestic assault that it is the intent to cause fear or inflict bodily harm.
Ms. Lambert, I thought earlier in your argument, just a few minutes ago, I thought that you basically agreed that the district court instructed the jury only on assault fear. Is that true?
So the district court instructed the jury on assault fear under the element. If you look at the jury instructions above that, in regards to the definition, the subheading and actually the definition says under Minnesota law, whoever commits an act with intent to cause fear in another immediately bodily harm or death or intentionally inflicts or attempts to inflict bodily harm upon another is guilty of a crime.
Then the district court proceeded to say, in this case, I forget the language used, but basically instructed the jury further only with respect to assault fear, right?
That's correct. The district court judge did instruct the jury that the term assault is an act with intent to cause Ms. Kyrus to fear bodily harm or death. But I will say as well that the judge gave other instructions that the lawyer's arguments are not the law, and that the jury should find that the law is as the judge gives it to them. There were no questions. There's no reason to think the jury was confused by the law as given by the judge. There weren't questions. There was not a hung jury in this case.
Do you have any case law for the proposition that if the prosecutor argues to the jury in closing that the elements are XYZ, when in fact the elements are different from that, that that's not a plain error?
I don't have any case law specifically to that, but on page 20 and 21 of my brief, I cite a number of cases that are examples of what misconduct is, and they are not. None of them have to do with what happened in this case.
Ms. Lambert, if I could follow up, because I think there are some cases that are cited in appellant's brief. Where even with that additional instruction from the court to that the arguments are not the law, that they have to follow the law as provided by the court, even with that instruction, misstating the elements is plain error. So are you saying that case is the Shannon case, State v. I don't know, Cow, CAO, that those cases are no longer good law, or do you concede that you can have plain error on the basis of misstating the elements, even when the district court says it's my instructions that you have to follow and the arguments are not law?
So in this situation, if I would have given my argument in relation to theft during a domestic assault, I think that is more of a clear-cut way of saying those elements were misstated. This case, even the defense attorney argued assault harm in this case. It's not misconduct to talk about someone's harm in order to prove the fear. And I talk about a lot of that, those intents of the appellant that his intent was to scare the victim throughout my closing argument. Again, my theory of the case was harm. And because of that harm, it is a circumstantially can prove the intent to cause fear. If you want to improve the intent of assault, you start by saying, well, this is what actually happened, and work your way backwards. I proved appellant was engaged in conduct the victim would have seen or heard, and the witnesses would have seen or heard. And that includes the punching in the face. Everything about assault harm were things the victim and the witnesses would have seen and heard. Again, appellant didn't sneak up on the victim.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure you're answering the questions that I asked and that I understand Judge Johnson was asking about the law regarding misstating elements to a jury. And it seems that there are cases where that misstatement of elements, even when the jury has been told, don't pay attention to the arguments, it's the law that I give you that matters. Even with that instruction, what we have found plain error. And I'm asking, do you think that those cases are no longer good law and that has been changed so that it's not plain error to misstate the elements of an offense?
I'm not saying that it's not good law. I just think that those cases have a more clear-cut distinction than the cases in this situation. If the court does find that there is plain error, the court would still have to determine that that misconduct did affect the appellant's substantial rights and would have to look at the strength of the state's case, which, as I argued, the state had a strong case here, the pervasiveness of the erroneous conduct, and whether the defendant had an opportunity to rebut any improper remarks. They did have a chance to rebut those at closing. They didn't make any objections at all during the closing argument that I gave. And like I stated, the state had a strong case in this matter.
But it seems, I mean, isn't the question here, Ms. Lambert? I mean, I think it's your burden now to convince us that though you stood in front of the jury and asked the jurors to find him guilty of assault harm based upon evidence that he punched her, and the jury came back with the verdict that you asked for, a verdict of guilty, I think you have to persuade us that the jury certainly would have reached the same decision with respect to assault fear if that had been the question before them, that there was not sort of a causal link between your argument and the verdict.
And I think I know my time is up, if I may answer that question. I believe I understand the question, Judge Johnson, but the jury did convict on assault fear. Again, there's no reason to think they didn't understand and didn't take the judge's jury instructions as they were written. And
one reason might be that they listened to your argument about the evidence of his punching her, and you're telling them that that's sufficient to prove assault harm, and they might have been convinced by that, and so they returned their verdict accordingly. That seems likely to me.
It's possible, but I think based on all the evidence in this case, a jury can reasonably, or the court can find that there was enough evidence to sustain a guilty verdict for assault fear in this case.
I'll pause to allow any follow-up questions. It appears there are none. Thank you, Ms. Lambert.
Thank you.
And Mr. Butler, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. And I wanted to start where Judge Johnson ended off, because it's something we didn't address, I don't think, in my argument, and that's the burden. On the misconduct issue, I was discussing with Judge Frisch whether the state's case was strong or weak, or how you characterize it, excuse me. But on the misconduct issue, it's the state's burden to convince you that essentially that the prosecutor's closing argument didn't matter, and that the jury would have ignored it and just followed the instruction and found the defendant guilty based on a theory that no one had talked about, and that for the evidence for which is, I would say, is equivocal. But whether you could put together a case for assault fear here or not is not the question. The question is, what was the likely impact of the prosecutor's closing argument on the jury? And can the prosecutor convince this court that there was no impact? And I would suggest that in this case, where we have such a narrow factual situation and such a clear distinction between the instructions and the arguments of counsel, that the state cannot carry its burden to prove that Mr. Larkins' substantial rights were not affected. We then get to prong four, and Judge Johnson and I discussed that earlier. And so I think that is one very, very possible way for the court to resolve this case. I did want to clarify one thing about the record. There was some discussion of Mr. Larkins running up to the victim, and there is testimony to that effect, but I think the distance matters. The young man, GK, at page 238 and 239, testified that Mr. Larkins and the complainant were no more than 3 feet away from each other before the punch. So we don't have Mr. Larkins running, through the house to punch the victim, or even across the room to punch the victim. What is 3 feet is a couple of steps. So he takes a couple of quick steps towards her and punches her. Maybe during those couple of quick steps, he intended that in that split second, he was trying to scare her. I guess it's possible, but I would argue that that's not the only reasonable inference on his intent in those facts. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court has. Otherwise, I would rest on the brief and ask you to repeat.
Mr. Butler, since I have you here, and it doesn't appear that the other judges have questions, I do want to ask something that it might be helpful to think about as we're looking at that fourth prong. Maybe you can help us understand exactly what that fourth prong is and how it's different from our structural error, for example. Is there anything that could affect the fairness of a proceeding such that we would reverse, but not also be structural error?
Yeah. So like, I'm sorry, Judge Brian, so is your question...
Well, tell me the distinction between the fourth prong mm-hmm. of plain error review yep. and structural error, because they seem on one hand to be the same question, really.
So I'll go back to the case, the most modern case that declines, in which the Supreme Court declined to reverse on prong four, is a railroad case. It's a civil case. I don't have the name in front of me, but you can look it up. I can send it to you. And it's a jury
instruction. I believe it's Frazier versus Santa Fe.
Thank you, Judge Johnson. That's exactly what it is. And so the in that case, as I recall, the party that later complained requested the instruction in question, right? So they said, please instruct the jury on X. And the judge did, and the jury found against the requesting party. Party later came on appeal and said, hey, X is wrong. Turns out X is wrong. You shouldn't have granted my request, and it was prejudicial. And the Supreme Court said, you know, you're right. It's wrong. It's error. It's plain because we've always said it was wrong. It's prejudicial because this was the whole issue in your case. So if we stop there, you get a new trial. I believe it was the plaintiff. But no, prong four, we're going to say no, because this is your fault. This is plaintiff's fault. And you can't set up the fault and then not object and then come asking us for a new trial. That's a prong four. That's not a misconduct case, but that's a prong for application. That's not this case. I realize defense attorney didn't say anything here, but the defense attorney doesn't have the burden. And it's not the defense attorney's obligation to point out that the instruction is wrong or is not, doesn't match the charge defense. It's the state's burden, the state's obligation. And the state doesn't get to just ignore the instruction given and argue however they want to, and then later show up on appeal and say, my argument didn't matter. I mean, I would suggest to the court that that's the exact opposite of Frazier, and that prong four, if prong four and Frazier cut against the plaintiff, the requesting party, prong four here goes the other way. It cuts against the party that is trying to ask you to say, don't pay any attention to what I said to the jury. They probably put the pieces together and did the right thing anyway. That's the opposite of prong four. I think we satisfy prong four, and we ask the court to reverse. Oh, Judge Johnson, you're on mute.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Thank you, Ms. Lambert, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That is the final case on today's oral argument calendar, and so the court is now in recess. Thank you.
Thank you.